Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday. Race fans, Sirius 219, XM 201. Sports Zone 964, listening to Sirius XM online and at our website, stevebick.com. And a juncture that we typically, we're starting to wrap up the Breeders' Cup postscript, but still plenty more conversation. Steve Haskin today. We'll get Tony Black as well and Rich Eng in the second half of the show. And early, Nick is going to be by, Nick Tamaro. And we want to start going over these cross-country pick fives that are hooking up Aqueduct and Churchill today. You've got off the turf in New York, but it doesn't affect the two races that are part of the pick five. Today you've got the 8th and 9th at Aqueduct and the 7th, 8th, 9th at Churchill. No bad weather at Churchill. I haven't seen, actually, anything from them on the potential for the wet track. Let's see. There's a little KK. Fast and good. There you go. So no problem for turf at Churchill, which is nice because the ninth race happens to be on the grass. So one of the five races today are on the turf. And Nick will come by, and he and I will go over it. I'm writing it up, and I want to get some input from Nick, too. There might be a very heavy lean in the first leg in Aqueduct, and then in the third leg at Aqueduct, you've got a maiden 25 where it doesn't look like anybody wants to win. It's one of those fields where, you know, there's horses that just keep, you know, running third and fourth, and you know, some of them have got performances that absolutely should have broken maidens, and they haven't. And so that gets a little thorny, and there's a couple of horses that at first glance don't look competitive, or you know, like win candidates, but in that kind of a field, when you've got a bunch of refuseniks, you got to go beneath the surface and try to scare them up. And I'm very anxious to hear what Nick's thoughts are on that ninth at Aqueduct. I mean, because the obvious contenders, Unbridled John and Tri Saint Lorenzo from Andy Latterer, and Wildcat West, and even Tis Envy. Those are your favorites. But I don't know. Uncle Ned is a new gelding. That appeals. And then Maya Engelhart's got Tis Me Bobby McGee making only a fourth start. You know, you look at horses like that, you know, even though, you know, most of the races, you know, this is a horse that's been beaten solidly. Same thing with Uncle Ned. But you're looking for something fresh and something new and different. And when it comes to Tis Me Bobby McGee, he's not a career maiden type look yet. He's only, you know, had a couple of starts. Second off the layoff. So we'll see. It just feels like a race where you can't be conservative, and you may have to try to get imaginative and use a couple of multiples that you would prefer not to. It'll happen. I suppose that the Michelle Nevin, our last buck, who David Aragona made even money in the first leg, the opening leg, yeah, horse to beat, but it is an open allowance. It's a, you know, it's an open group for a New York bred, and Not that, you know, New York Bread's an open company don't make sense, but we'll see. I mean, horse to beat, and I can see leaning. Even brings a bullet in to the spot. You do have the, there's a Noda, first line, 5-1. It's a little scary. So, anyway, we're going to go over it, Nick and I, and we'll give you some angles on it. It starts at 3:47 is first post for the Naira Betts Twin Spires daily cross-country pick five. This is going to be a lot of fun. Any day that the both tracks run, there's going to be a cross-country. And we'll also get some recapping from Nick. We won't ask him much about his BCBC run because there wasn't one, but but that's okay. Nick can still provide perspective on the 2 days of racing. We'll also talk to Dick. Dick Powell is going to join us first in about 12, 14, 15 minutes, and we'll get Dick's Breeders' Cup story. See how he did. And in fact, two of the visitors, that had offerings out there, analysis for Breeders' Cup. So we'll both Rich and Dick, and we'll talk a little. HKJC as well. And there's also, I've got kind of a hybrid topic, not so much for Dick, but we're going to be joined top of hour two. Alan Foreman's going to swing by. It was a very positive presentation from the Mid-Atlantic yesterday. And the numbers, the fatality rate has dropped this year significantly. And we've talked to repeatedly many times to Alan as the Mid-Atlantic group has developed a series of protocols, and it really has been widely instituted and incorporated around the game, that and there's still potential for other regions and jurisdictions to latch on to it. So we'll let Alan break out some of the details some of the findings. Dr. Scott Palmer involved obviously as well, and should be good. Time well spent. And Tony and Haskin. All right. So let me catch up on a few other pieces of news, including, and I really I haven't had a chance to send a text to Andy Beyer. And if the weather's okay down there, he's probably bicycling by now. But yesterday, the joint press release from Breeders' Cup, or really from Keeneland and Equibase, regarding the time of the Classic and utilizing multiple video angles and everything that they could bring to bear against this study, they've come up with splits with fractions and a final time of exactly 1:59:03, 1:59:06:0. The splits, 23-1, 46-4, 1:10:1, and 1:34:3. And so, And they're pretty convinced from what they could tell that indeed the beam, the seeing eye, was tripped inadvertently, and that's why the 17 seconds came up and whatever. It's ironed out, I guess. But I do want to ask Andy if he's on board with that time. You know, it's somewhere in there, it seems. I mean, there's now, between the hand timing and this work, using the replay, they were down around 159 and 1, and then we had as high as 159 and 4. And so this feels like it's where Andy was talking. And it also, you know, 23 and 1, 46 and 4. You know, that's a slow opening quarter, but some of that's affected by run-up. But still, the even 46 and 4, I mean, that's, you know, for a mile and a quarter, that's a square split. But, you know, 46 and 4 for a horse like Authentic in rhythm, 110 and 1, 134. So he got an easy, comfortable lead and was able to, you know, get into that comfortable rhythm that pretty much made it clear he was not going to, you know, he was not going to be reeled in. And as much as Improbable tried, and boy, Improbable is going to get the figure, at least on Thoroughgraph, that Authentic got in the Preakness, because he was wide, you know, every step. Improbable ran great again. He had a very good year, and your champion, your older horse champion, coming out of it. Let's face it, the difference in horse of the year. I mean, Improbable wins, he's horse of the year. Authentic wins, he's horse of the year. So there we go. But that's the news on the timing. And I didn't really see what kind of reaction. I really should get a hold of CJ, too. CJ Malkowski, see what some of CJ's thoughts were. And I mentioned, you know, with Alan's visit, and Dick Powell's going to join us just about 5 minutes. And in Australia, I thought this was worth mentioning. And it kind of folds in with what I was referencing with Alan's visit. In the wake of Anthony Van Dyke's breakdown, and frankly, in wake of the series of Melbourne Cup injuries and fatalities, they've in Australia, the New South Wales Trainers Association, they're calling for rules that would enhance the ship-in protocols for, you know, horses coming in for the carnival and for Melbourne Cup. You know, Cliffs of Moher, Red Keddo, Wichita in the 2000 Guineas earlier this year. So, or, you know, this, any number of them. And it sort of feeds into this storyline with the Mid-Atlantic. A couple of other news and notes, too. We've got day three wrapped up at Keeneland yesterday. Had the conversation with Nicole Russo. Yesterday, Hillendale offered contributing the Medaglia d'Oro mare that's carrying a Spitestown baby and Coteau Grove, Louisiana. $500,000, $500,000 for contributing. And with that, of course, you know, that's the beauty of buying, you buy a mare in foal. You get the mare, you get the baby, and you get to keep the mare and breed back. And then you got a nice product with the mare. And in fact, there was another Spitestown later, or actually earlier on the docket, Gold Sock, that was also bought by Coteau Grove and is also carrying a Spitestown and Medaglia d'Oro mare. So they had a plan, obviously, going in yesterday. In fact, a lot of the of the top sellers, the top, you know, 10 or so, you had four covered mares that were sold. Summer Luck, Pat Costello and Paramount offering the Looking at Lucky mare, who's carrying a Constitution. Woodford bought that one for $335. You had another Constitution baby that Stephanie's sister is carrying, the Kitten's Joy mare. Bedouin bloodstock offered, and this one looks like she's going to Japan. Kachiro Yamaguchi, $350. And then the other top-selling hips were all weanlings. And that included a couple more Justifies for big money, $435 for the colt out of State Classy San Diego. And that was consigned by Elm Tree, bought by Bakari. Larry Best, the Into Mischief colt for $400,000, Paramount, and this one out of Slough Found Money, which was pretty sure is was a Mrs. Weber mare, right? I think so. And that was $400,000. Also for $400,000, a filly offered by Warrendale and bought by Stone Street, a Mastery filly, $400,000. City of Light with another score, also a Stone Street purchase, filly. Offered by Eaton, $375. Another Stuart Morris offered one, a colt by Justify, hip 987, $375,000. And Larry Best, who, you know, was quoted as saying he, you know, he did want to diversify a little bit. He said, you know, can't be all Into Mischief. He bought a Good Magic, offered by Bedouin, out of In Love with Love, $360,000. So some very nice numbers on the weanling side of things as the sale continues at Canelet. Day four today, and the numbers are okay. I mean, they're solid. They're not not spectacular, but in light of where we are in the situation, it's been pretty good. It continues to be, tracking solidly down. I mean, it's not, just like we said yesterday, it's just, but it's down, but not, not so down that, people are jumping off bridges. So it's, we hope. Dick Powell is going to join us here momentarily, and as we wait for Dick, let me get in yesterday's Churchill action, some of the races we talked about with Ed DeRosa, and those sort of co-features. You did have the one race off the turf, and the MTOs did dominate in there. Movie Moxie, Eddie Keneally. He's magically delicious for the hills, for Jim and Susan Hill. This was a Bon Chance Farm Street Sense filly. Movie Moxie romped under Florent Giroux. And you also had the horse. Actually, the Street of Dreams ran okay, that stayed in the race for Ian Wilkes. And Vicky Oliver had Storm at Sea off the MTOs. Was third. Ready to Answer in that maiden race, the nightcap, this Rusty Arnold, also for the hills. And so Jim and Susan Hill with the late double at Churchill. What did that pay? Let's see. What did the hill double? 25-30. 8-1 on Ready to Answer with Giroux as well. And that Fastly, the favorite, ran okay, but couldn't get to Ready to Answer. And it was a good race, actually, that maiden race. And I was waiting. Tina and I went down to Albany, and had a bunch of things to do. I had a little weird hiccup with the computer, which is fairly new, and so then very sad. I got a quick aside as Dick joins us. We were down at Crossgates, and you know, the news, of course, in the last 6 weeks or so, maybe give or take 8 weeks, that Lord & Taylor is closing. And it's really sad to me, the state and the affair of of the great department stores. My first jobs were in, were in retail, and worked for Wallach's, the men's clothing store, Hartshafter Marks, and I worked for, my first job ever was with Forbes and Wallace. Those of you in and around Springfield certainly remember Forbes, and I worked in the big Springfield, in the flagship, as it were, an old fashioned 8-story, 10-story department store. And when we go to Philadelphia, we go to the old Wanamakers, now Macy's. But to me, it's just they're the old fashioned department stores that we grew up with. And particularly, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be in the Northeast either. But Lord & Taylor. That just the saddest scene to me. So Tina was shopping anyway, and so I was watching. Happened to watch the race from Churchill. So I can remember. I was working in Manhattan when B. Altman closed, and our office was on Fifth Avenue, 42nd and Fifth. And B. Altman was like 6 blocks down, and I remember going to, when B. Altman was closing, and I wanted to buy something, and I bought a kaleidoscope, a beautiful brass kaleidoscope, small, sort of small one from B. Altman, and I don't know why. I guess just because I worked in retail, and I can remember. When living in Cincinnati, when Shillito Reichs was, they weren't closing at that time, but their dining room, a dining room in a department store, was a big deal. I don't know how old everybody is that's listening, but a lot of you are nodding your head. And I remember the week that Shillito's was going to be the last week of their restaurant. And my friend Patty Kessner, Patty and Doug, who we visited, the Warsaw Falcons, we went in January to see them play. And Patty and I went because I wanted to go. I should have stole some silverware, actually. It had the logo and everything on it. I don't know. This is one of those. I've got tons of recipes too from the department store dining rooms. It was a big, big deal, believe me. For those of you that are like, what do you mean? Listen, I the lunch counter at Kresge to me and Woolworth was a big deal. For those that that know that, even for an egg salad sandwich, didn't have to be a Waldorf salad and chicken a la king like you would get at a department store dining room. With the elevator operators and that dial and closing the sliding gate, it's a very vivid image for me. So there you go. Before I get misty here, Dick Powell, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. We take things like that for granted. But if you're a writer and you use metaphors, let's say you're talking about boxing and there are two boxers with a, close fighting style. Well, the metaphor would always be you could hold this bout in a phone booth. Well, what is a phone booth? You don't see phone booths anymore. You don't have pay phones anymore. No. The last reference to a phone booth was Robert De Niro finding out that Joe Pesci got whacked at his ceremony, and he kicks the phone booth over. outside the diner in Queens. That's a phone booth. You don't have phone booths anymore. And then no one knows what you're talking about when you bring up phone booths. So there's a lot of things like that. Yeah, gone and gone for good, probably. Not coming back.
There's an article in the Times a couple of days ago, and I saved it in my pocket file and to go back to read, and I just glanced at it. All of those phone booth stanchions, you know, the phones have been taken out, but the stanchions are still there, and the frame, the aluminum framework is still, you know, sitting there clogging up street corners, and they're apparently all going to be removed. And this article is about how some artists have sort of co-opted them and are doing things with them as they sit there. So I want to I'll find that and tweet it out. And since I went in this direction regarding some articles and things, there's real interest in the Netflix Queen's Gambit about the young chess prodigy. Have you followed this?
I've heard about it. I haven't seen it.
We haven't watched it either yet, but it's got a big. Apparently, it's, you know, the wave right now on Netflix. And Dave Hill, you know, who racing treasures sort of the writer our go-to writer, Dave Hill has got a terrific piece in The Ringer about the late author of The Queen's Gambit and the whole backstory. And it's just terrific. You got to. I sent it out. If you didn't yesterday, if people didn't see my on my feed, and you know, you'll instantly be familiar with Walter Tevis, who wrote The Queen's Gambit, the author of The Hustler and The Color of Money, and he died very young, 53, I think. Dave writes, but he's got a profile of Tevis, and it, really worth your time at The Ringer. Dave's had a busy week because he's also he also has embedded himself with a bunch of gamblers and has got this new. It's called Gamblers. It's an anthology podcast, and it's just being introduced. So, and then, of course, there's his book, The Vapors, which, you know, is the book of the year. And so it's all Dave Hill all the time. but The Queen's Gambit, we're going to watch this weekend.
That's well, right. I got a list of things to watch, and the list gets longer, and I don't get any closer to watching them. So it'll go on the list.
There
all
you
I
go.
Can say.
All right, look at that.
One last thing with phone booths.
Yes.
Back when laptops used to have a couple hour battery life, you'd go in an airport and you'd have that line of phone booths, not real private, but, you know, just one after another.
Sure.
And a lot of them had AC power. So I would sit down and plug in my laptop and just have the phone up to my ear in case anyone needed to use the phone. I'd just get a quick half hour charge on my laptop for my next flight.
Very clever.
That was a little traveler's trick from way back. Now I see the new Apple MacBook's going to have 17-hour battery life, so don't have to worry about that anymore.
Well, something disappeared. My download access. I could download stuff, but then when I went to go pull them up, nothing was showing up. It was the craziest thing, and it was very strange. It was as if it only started in August. That was like the first downloads that were available. So it was like September, October had like disappeared, I guess, had disappeared. Very strange. And so I don't know. There was a guy, I'll tell you, the Apple store, I had kind of a young, chipper kid that was helping me. And then he got kind of stymied because he couldn't find it. And at the front of the room, there was a kid that is big, big kid. And he was sitting, and it literally was like, it was like that scene in that Google movie with Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn, and you know, he's clearly, you know, he's clearly like the Yoda of all the Apple geniuses, and they all go to him, and you know, when they can't figure something, it was the funniest thing. And so then, as we're going out, I gave him like this respectful nod, and he gave me, you know, he gave me sort of the, you know, the, you know, the knowing yes. You know, go forth, my son, and use your new MacBook Air, and it was very funny. It's an interesting experience.
I've never had that happen. So I'll call you if it does.
Well, my first place to go is Casey. First I run it by Casey because he's got all Apple. He's got tons of Apple equipment. And then if Case can't explain it to me, you know, then I'm in trouble actually. But I had to go anyway because my old laptop for like $435, they're gonna clear it completely and you know, redo it. So I thought, you know what, I should have this as a backup. And at first I wasn't gonna, but then I thought it's crazy not to get this thing reconditioned. So
well, they used to have these things called typewriters. And if you learned on a typewriter, you had to hit the keys pretty good.
Oh yeah.
And my problem now is even my last MacBook Air is probably 5 years old. The one before that, which is still sitting here, I actually wear the keys off. I mean, I actually have keys that I can't even read.
Sure.
I touch type. And I don't even realize I'm doing it, but when I'm typing and I hit enter, I punch it. Bam. Because that's what, on a typewriter, that's what you had to do. And I'm way too rough on hitting the keys. So usually the technology, the you know, the software, the insides holds up, but the physical property of having these, you know, smooth, sleek keys on a keyboard taking up little space and everything else, and then here I come along, just pound the crap out of them. So I'm probably due for a new one, and I see the new one that they just came out with. It's like, wow. So, yeah. Probably not at the Apple Store. My wife bought me a new iPad for my birthday. And my other one was, I had to have been 10 years old. I won it at a conference. It was a mini. And I decided I was going to get a new one. So for my birthday, she got it, came by mail, got on it, put the other iPad with the Bluetooth enabled next to it, everything, apps, everything crossed over. It couldn't have been any easier. So hopefully if I get a new MacBook Air, it'll be just as easy. No reason why not.
Well, since you included typewriting in this conversation, I'll mention the last typewriter that I had. When I went to college, when I was leaving for Colgate, my parents got me as a high school graduating present, I guess, as part of a thing. And in addition to, you know, cross pen sets, that, you know, that's a very big deal when I was graduating high school. But they gave me, at the time, it didn't mean much to me. It was a Smith Corona portable typewriter that had like a cover. It was very sleek. It was flat and had like a, it was almost like a flat trapezoid shape. And I bring this up because there's a racing connection to one of my favorite people in the game, which is Isabella De Tomaso. And her husband, who was one of the, you know, one of the great race car designers of his era, designed that typewriter. And at the time, it was marveled as a you know, as a design triumph, and realized years later the connection. Very funny. So,
yeah. Did you bring it with you to the Haskell?
No, but that's funny. I should have Mrs. De Tomaso autograph it. Yeah, exactly. That's it. very fun. Anyway, we've gone. Boy, if you and I are going far afield, then wait till Haskin shows up. Then we're this will really blow the turn. Dick, before we talk about HKJC weekend and yesterday, your Breeders' Cup to give us your Breeders' Cup tales of triumph.
Saturday was real good. Saturday was excellent. Did not like what they did to the track for the weekend. And it might have happened before 11 o'clock in the morning, but there was a breakdown in race two on the dirt. And it's like, you know, how many times do you people have to see, you know, hard tracks, not good for horses' health? And also, how do you hold your championship event and have a surface that is unfair to, I'm not saying half the horses, but a bunch of horses had virtually no shot in those races. So that's me on my soapbox. Didn't like that part of it. The Keeneland setting was spectacular. The weather, oh my God, like you couldn't pay me to go to a Breeders' Cup at Keeneland. But if you called me up Thursday night and said, hey, Dick, do you want to go? I would have said, yeah, because this is 75 degrees, and it just looked fantastic on television. So that part was great. The racing was competitive. I was really thrilled with Luis Saez because not only did he have the winner of the juvenile on Friday, but Louis had 3 seconds on Saturday. Louis was riding really, really good. And just, I'm a big Louis Saez fan, so I was so happy to see him have a good Breeders' Cup, show that he can compete on the biggest stage, like he's already shown before, but now with Kieran McLaughlin as his agent, I think Louis is going to get better and better mounts. He ventured out to California this fall, picked up some really solid horses with Peter Miller and Bob Baffert, things like that. And I think that will just continue. So I was happy for Louis. I was happy for Pierre Charles Boudot, who picks up a couple of catch mounts and wins. And Colin Keane winning the turf on Tonawa. And I love Tonawa. I just at a mile and a half, I thought she would be super, super tough. She was. Now, top of the stretch, I wasn't terribly happy as far back as she was, how wide she was, but just that last quarter mile, she was absolutely brilliant. Magical, who was a great second, will be coming to Hong Kong next month. So Aidan O'Brien said she would be in Hong Kong to finish out her career, and that'll be great to see her there. Brad Cox, just awesome weekend, just fantastic. And you know, I listened to your interview with Ron Moquette on Monday. It was so good. I listened to it twice, and I was just so happy that Ron got that win with Whitmore, and he keeps this horse, you know, firing bullets at the age of seven. And you know, if he gets the trip, he's great. If he doesn't get the trip, you know, he's not going to win. He got the trip, then he won. So fantastic. And Nashville reminds me of Mr. Prospect, the 107-4, Prospect did it his second career start or third career start, but very similar going 107-4 that early in their lives. And he is just, I wish the Asmussens could have had a, you know, like a private match race with Volatile and Nashville. Among other horses that Steve has. You can't imagine how fast those horses would be if they were, you know, challenging each other. And Gamine was fantastic, you know, Serengeti Empress. I mean, Louis hustled her. You couldn't hustle a horse more than Louis hustled her out of the gate, because his instructions were get out there, and he did. And Johnny just kind of let her go and eased outside, and which was the trip that we all were hoping that Tis the Law would get. But he didn't. He's outside. He backed off, and man, he had his feet in the dashboard down the backstretch, and that was it for Tis the Law. I did see Andy and Maggie on Talking Horses Sunday morning, and they were fantastic. I mean, Andy criticized jockeys. Okay, that's not newsworthy. But Maggie can be really tough. And the two of them were just tremendous going over the race and what they thought should have happened. So, you know, lots of stuff to watch and follow. You know, I stayed home, sat in my living room. I had TV on upstairs, TV on in the dining room, TV on in the man cave. My wife's in Florida. My kids, my grandkids are with their father, so I didn't have any distractions, interruptions, anything, especially Saturday. So I just sat here, watched them, bet them, talked on the phone to different people. It was fantastic. Plus, it's over at 5:30. It's like, all right, you know, it's not going to 7:30 at night, so.
Agreed. The early finish was okay, as you know, I was able to make it back to as far as Erie, which is much further than I usually I cannot get past Mid Ohio. But you're leaving Derby, you know, you're lucky to get out of there at 7:30, 8 o'clock, you know, so makes it hard. But yeah, I agree. I will say one thing, Dick. I'll bring this up with you because you might have a nice appreciation or a interesting, you know, response. The sooner we're able to start getting the complete fan base and horse player base and anybody else, casual attendees, the sooner we get bodies in quantity into these venues, the better off we're going to be. There was a little too much comfort with the scenario of just, you know, just a very finite group of attendees, that part of it was a little disconcerting. We got to get people back in the buildings as soon as possible.
Yes, especially with the same people being partners on all the same horses.
That's a whole different topic. Yeah. I hear you. All right, let's. I'm glad you had a great weekend, and you know, you and Hammer Hammer was on Adaria, but you with Tarnawa. There were horses. There were definitely horses at nice prices to key off of, and it only takes a couple over the course of the 2 days. Dick, turn our attention toward HK and the Hong Kong weekend. I couldn't pay attention Saturday night into Sunday morning. So let us know what went on.
Hey, we'll go back a couple of weeks. We had the ladies' purse. Group 2, mile and an eighth, Furore, beat stablemate Exultant. Tony Cruz ran 1-2. We'll see both of them back on the big Longines International races coming up in 3 weeks. Final time was very fast, 145.91. So they look like they will be ready for whatever invaders will be coming in from out of town. Yesterday, kind of a crazy day. Race 2, Matthew Poon just missed with 134-1 shot, which, as we've talked about many times, he's been known to do. Unfortunately, a couple of races later, his horse broke down the backstretch. He was injured. I read the account about it. I read something about it this morning. It doesn't seem to be hurt that bad, but under the very strict rules in Hong Kong racing. I mean, he will not even be allowed to ride track work until the medical staff at Hong Kong pronounces him fit and ready to go. The horse was okay. It was, you know, lame and right fore leg, I think it was. But he also can't even train. And they also said if he trains, he has to have a senior rider on him, which was interesting. So they want any young kids getting on a horse that might not be 100%. So, you know, typical Hong Kong, staying on top of everything. Some crazy thing here, Steve. The last three meets, the final times have all been slower than standard time, with one exception. So there's like 29 races. Only one race was faster than par. And I don't really understand that, because they, you know, the one car that was raced with the rail at the A position, which is, you know, what we would consider to be zero. They don't have a hedge, but the closest thing to it. And it wasn't, the turf was good. It wasn't rain or softened or anything else. So that was kind of a, from out of nowhere, that has showed up. Don't know why, but I just keep track of things. I can't explain everything, but I can notice everything. The other crazy thing that's been going on is the last two race cards are shot in. Favorites are 1-for-20. The last two race cards at Happy Valley, favorites are 2-for-18. So that's 3-for-38 in the last four race cards on turf. 8% favorites winning. Now, on the all-weather track, because remember a week and a half ago, on a weekday, they ran an entire all-weather meet at Shot 10 on a Wednesday. And that day, 5 out of 9 favorites won. So that's kind of the anomaly. But the turf racing has been wide open, competitive. Not outrageous bombs, though. You know, that they've been horses that you could have, you know, 7-to-1, 10-to-1, stuff like that. Not crazy prices, but just favorites of not winning. But yesterday, the last race, Joe Moreira won for Casper Founds and was odds on. But other than that, yesterday the cheapest price was $11.30. So that's been another trend, that Shot 10 turf started out almost 40% the first 5 or 6 meets this year. Now it's gone the opposite. So once again, we'll track it. Can't always explain it. Joe Moreira continues to lead in the riders, because the big story has been Zach Purton, which could have picked up ground with Joe having a 2-meet suspension, only picked up one win in that time. So Joe's at 32. Zach is tied with Karis Teton for second with 23. Vincent Ho is at 18. Zach is 7 out of his last 71 mounts. With the trainers, Casper Founds has a big lead, 22 wins. Last year's champion, Francis Liu, 15, Frankie Law, 14, Tony Cruz, who finished last year real good, continues at ES 13. Casper is 8-for-63 the last 30 days, and he always does his best work at Happy Valley. Well, this year, 13 out of those 22 races came at Happy Valley. So Casper's just killing it at Happy Valley. So this weekend, big difference. Friday night, Saturday morning. Saturday, you know, off Friday night, midnight, East Coast time, 9 p.m. Friday night, Pacific time, we have our 10-race card at Shot 10. The following week is Happy Valley on the normal Wednesday morning East Coast time zone. Couple of picks. Race 1, we're going to go, this is a class 5, 0-40, low-rated horses. I'm going to go with number 8, Amazing Agility. Won its last start going longer, turns back to a mile, but has won at this distance before. It's had 2 starts this year. Both were very good. No reason from post-8 and still not being heavily weighted. No reason to think he can't run another good race, especially going 1,600 meters where they have that long run down the backstretch. So first race, number 1, Amazing Agility. Second race is kind of odd. It's a class 4. We have 5 first-time starters in here. They're going 1,000 meters, the straightaway. I looked at the training races for the first-time starters. A couple of them are good, but I'm going to try to beat them with number 4, United We Stand. This is a Jerry Chow mount, so Jerry gets 7 pounds off. He used up his 10-pound bug. Now he's down to 7, but still 7 is a big advantage for him. The horse, the last two starts, drew post 11 and 10. Now he draws post 6, gets in light again. United we stand against a field of pretty inexperienced horses. Has a lot of speed and go on the straightaway. I think he will be tough. And then we're going to go on to race 7, which is kind of the feature race of the night. This is a $3 million Hong Kong dollar class 1 handicap. They're going to go 1,400 meters. I'm going number 5, Starshine. This is a one-dimensional deep closer. But last couple of starts has been flying up the wire. Draws much better tonight with post 5. He's had post 14, post 10. So he'll be flying with Joe Barrera, and I think he can get up in time in this very competitive race. So race 7 will go with number 5, Starshine.
Excellent.
And that's our Hong Kong report.
I appreciate it, Dick, and start to look forward to the races in December particularly, and got a couple other things. I'll save that. I'm going to save that for our visit with. I mentioned the situation in Australia. I'm going to bring up with Alan Foreman after Nick Tamaro joins us, and about the trying to figure out a way to help the imports acclimate the horses that come in for Melbourne Cup. This reaction,
they got a problem. They got to do something.
Exactly.
Plus the turf was way too firm for the Melbourne Cup. Third fastest in history, 3:17 for 2 miles. It's just brutally hard. So,
we'll see. What I want to see what Alan's reaction on that one is as well. Well, Dick, good luck this week, and we'll talk next week. Thanks for everything.
Thanks, Steve. Talk then. Bye.
You got it. Dick Powell, everybody, HKJC, and we'll look forward to a couple of minutes. I wanted to get Nick in, and I guess Casey, Casey having trouble? Maybe? All right. No trouble. There he is. Nick Tamaro. Good morning. I think. Nick?
Good morning, Steve.
There you go. We're a little late to you. I'm sorry.
Well, you and I have the time zone thing, and so I've started putting stuff in the central time zone because you did, and so I'm at 9:30-ish central time. But it's cool. I'm always ready for you.
That a boy. All right. I'm sorry. We'll have our full regular Friday get together looking ahead to the weekend. And I haven't even talked really about what was drawn yesterday, but back into the swing. They got the Revere at Churchill on Saturday. And we're going to be at Aqueduct. We've got both the Artie Schiller and the Notebook. And I think the bad weather is passing through us for the most part, but we'll save, we'll save our Breeders' Cup wrap with you for tomorrow. That way you can, it gives you an extra 24 hours to figure out, what didn't happen exactly.
Steve, you could give me until next year to recap this Breeders' Cup and I'll figure out what the hell happened.
It happens.
But it's okay. I can certainly wait 24 hours for it. I think the public can certainly wait on that as well. It will be quite the raucous recap.
I love it. Well, some years Marshall was able to provide the raucous recap.
Yes, absolutely. That's the that for sure is the thing that's gone well, and at that, we can all be happy about.
Yeah, it was nice. We had a lot of fun, and people enjoyed hearing the blow-by-blow details. So let's save, we'll save Breeders' Cup for tomorrow. What we're going to do, whenever we get a chance, if it fits our schedules, we're going to provide everybody with some, hopefully some insights on this daily cross-country pick five. Aqueduct and Churchill hooked up together. Today, it's Aqueduct 7, Churchill, excuse me, Aqueduct 8, Churchill 7, Aqueduct 9, and then Churchill 8 and 9. And let's dive in and get through it. Everybody take some notes. And it starts with a mile and an eighth open allowance, Nick. And, you know, the heavy lean feels like it's going to be our last buck, the even money favorite, coming off of a win. But the win is, you know, second level statebreds, and has got to, you know, has got to beat some open company types here. And you know, I guess that's the rub. It took him a long time to clear his statebred conditions, and I don't know. I'm obviously he's the horse to beat, and he's been in the exact each of his last five starts. He's going to go a mile and an eighth for the second time. And he was, you know, he was a long way behind Evaluator in the Saratoga Slop in September. So what do you think?
Yeah, you know, this is a handicapping quandary that comes up often with the New York breds because they retain open conditions despite going through the restricted ones. And, yeah, I think it's a question of him catching the right field. I don't know if he would necessarily be a very heavy favorite in a normal one other than. This appears to be a weaker than par one other than, and you know, one of the things that he has going for him is that he's generally been, I don't want to say better on sloppy surfaces, but you know, the saying that denying that does belie the speed figures that he's earned in those scenarios. He's got an 89 and a 90 figure on sloppy sealed track. So obviously if the rain is heavy and the track is sloppy, that will only help his chances. He drew well on the outside. It's a small field anyway. And, you know, I think the biggest issue, Steve, is there's just not really an alternative. I could understand people maybe wanting to try Dudley Square, who's getting his first opportunity around two turns since a race where he lost his rider at the start. And, you know, I get that Todd Fletcher generally does well with these types, and more distance is a good thing for the majority of his horses. But I don't know. This horse doesn't exactly scream a mile and an eighth to me. Todd's gotten off to a really good start at the meet, so I could see including him maybe as a backup. But I think given the way this sequence shakes out, you're pretty much going to lean heavily on our last buck and just try and get out of the first leg with a cheapie.
Yeah, the horse right next to him scares me a little bit. This first line, the note is, you know, come it tried the Jim Dandy and, you know, then came back in a regular allowance in the beginning of October. I don't know. I just... the horse has gone a mile and an eighth twice and, in fact, broke the maiden at Saratoga going a mile and an eighth. Might recall one of those, you know, one of those, what, eight or nine wins at Saratoga for Noda. So I would love to be able to single our last buck, but I'm a little edgy. I'll decide once I finalize the ticket. Second, let's, what you want to do it by leg? Let's do it by leg, I think, is probably smarter.
Yeah, so we'll swing over to Churchill.
Yeah, Churchill 7th, which is the one-turn mile, and this is another six-horse field, and this also, you know, seems to have a horse that, you know, ran a race back in December of last year that would, you know, would win this. That's Beautiful Trauma on the inside, Amos and Giroux. But I don't know. I'm not convinced of that one either. That's a race that was won on a wet track.
So funny 30-second anecdote, because the public is really going to just gobble this up. I kid, of course. But so I worked briefly in my day job as a teacher, and I had a student who saw me reading the racing form, which, of course, I should have been doing during work hours, and he told me, oh, my father owns some racehorses. And it turns out his father is named Greg Hoffman, who is the Hoffman of Hoffman Family Racing that owns Beautiful Trauma. And we became friendly, and he was very excited about this horse early on, and Tom Amos was as well. She had that huge blowout win at Fairgrounds and then came back off a layoff and ran into what I think was a much saltier bunch than she faces today. So I think she's very dangerous from the inside. If you're watching the early races at Churchill, keep an eye on how the main track plays. It seemed to me that yesterday, as the day went on, it was advantageous to be towards the inside. Maybe what I should say is that it was disadvantageous to be outside. And I think those two things are a little bit different. You didn't necessarily have to be on the rail, but from about race six on, I really don't think you wanted to be making that big outside move. We saw a heavy favorite hang like a chandelier in the nightcap and end up losing. And then in the eighth, the winner stayed in the two-path the whole way. So if we see the similar kind of track profile, obviously that would help Beautiful Trauma. I think the main alternative to me is Resurrection Road, who's got a lot of speed, but probably is suited to the mile as much as she is going two turns. And I think that, you know, theoretically, this is a cutback. It's a turn back more so than it is a cutback because the distance is not much shorter. But I do think the one-turn trip could end up playing out really well for her. And I thought that they were the main two that I wanted. I could see maybe a little bit of support for Sarah C, given the company that she's kept. I think there's reason to believe that she can be competitive. French Empire was also claimed by Cipriano Contreras last time, and we've seen him do very well off the claim. However, I thought it was interesting. He's just 3% with a 62-cent ROI, claiming horses and bringing them back in dirt routes. So not necessarily the strongest angles for his barn, and that might relegate her to more of a backup for me.
Back to New York for the third leg, and this ninth is... is a maiden 25, the maiden 25 from hell, is essentially, where you've got a lot of horses that are already easy to identify as career maidens, and some that are on their way to being a career maiden. There are a couple of horses that, you know, that have reasons to consider them, you know, as double digit players, including Tisme, Bobby McGee, and Uncle Ned that I mentioned earlier this morning. Even Confectioner, there's a little hint of something might end up in, you know, with the lead here, and you know, kind of take them along their way. Tis Envy, what's the approach here, Nick, that gets us through this leg?
I think you want to cast a wide net. You want to use as many as you can afford. I think the favorite ultimately is going to be Unbridled John, who, you know, inspires no confidence whatsoever. He comes off a race where if he duplicates it, he wins, period. There's really no conversation about it. He ran very well that day. It was a somewhat surprising performance. You know, this was a horse that, with all due respect to Gary Contessa, the now retired Gary Contessa, most of us felt good about Unbridled John the first time he ran for Bruce Brown because we thought it was a trainer upgrade. And looking at statistics and percentages, it is a trainer upgrade. But it definitely took him a while to get going, and maybe Bruce ultimately deciding that this is a horse that wants to go longer was the key in figuring him out, because now that he's gone a mile on dirt last time and is doing so again, he's in a scenario where he can be most effective. Having that speed, you know, I know you have some affinity for Benji Hernandez. I think he's very good when it comes to horses with one style, you know, where he's not really going to do anything. There's nothing else that needs to be done, and this is a horse whose style is simply to go to the lead. Uncle Ned, who you mentioned, is a new gelding. Inside post is not necessarily ideal, but I think his style is going to be to drop out and make one run anyway, so it probably won't help terribly. I was also somewhat interested in Tisme, Bobby McGee, who I thought had some angles in a race where you're really just reaching for anything you can possibly find. You know, I'll throw a crazy horse out there to include if you can afford it, and maybe just as a backup. But Cetus Kid had a second-place finish at 99-1 on a day where the track was, where there was a huge pick-six carryover a couple of years ago. This horse has largely been facing 30 and 40 maiden claimers that were much, much tougher than what he's meeting in here. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Getting Hem and Harkey away from him is a good thing. And Romero Mirage is an upgrade. This is a horse that sprinted last time. Maybe it's going to put a little bit more speed into him. His big problem is that he's just been totally devoid of any early energy in any start. He's a horse who could come clunking along at 30 or 40 to 1 and put a scare into this field. And it's just that kind of race. I mean, you'll look back on it afterwards and say, boy, I should have included him because he had races that would make him competitive, and they weren't really that much slower than any. One horse we haven't mentioned is Height, who's coming back to New York, back downstate from Finger Lakes. been facing open maiden special weight foes of late. Hasn't really done a whole heck of a lot. Did end up in a fast-paced race last time, but didn't do any running. This is a horse that, going back, has some ability. And Carl Grusmark generally does well in the wintertime at Aqueduct. I figured you probably had to include him. And Tri St. Lorenzo is another one I'm going to use. Again, in light with Luis Cardenas. The mile is probably not as ideal for him as going a little bit shorter, but he just seems a little too obvious to exclude. So it's a very tough race, and one where I think you're going to want to use as many as possible, because it just is virtually impossible to have any confidence other than to take a horse like Unbridled John at a much shorter price than you should be taking any horse in this race.
Did you address Wildcat West?
Wildcat West is re-entered tomorrow, so he will not run today.
Oh, good. Okay. I didn't look ahead yet. Nice. All right. I'm glad, actually, because I didn't want
to. Well, it was one of those races where a scratch horse actually provided relief.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Back to Churchill for the fourth leg. And this is a maiden race that's buried in here. And you've got firsters for the most part. You do have a couple of horses that have run. Ben Colebrook has got a Looking at Lucky cardio version, and Tom Amos has got a second timer, an upstart filly. They're all fillies. Zoom Up, that's 3-1, and ran okay at about 7-1 in the debut at Keeneland, October 23rd. There's Jim and Susan Hill, who closed out yesterday, sweeping the double, and there's some other nice win early type pedigrees that are involved in here. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought that that Mind for Passion on the outside was interesting. I think it would also be kind of interesting that Jim and Susan Hill will have won those three races with three different trainers if Mind for Passion ends up winning. I think one was Canalee and one was Rusty Arnold yesterday. So. Mind for Passion, I thought, looked very interesting. The workouts looked good, drawn favorably on the outside. I didn't think that Zoom Up ran particularly well on debut, and I'm not sure how much he's going to move forward at second asking. I will say that Amos is 26% with two-year-old second-time starters in maiden special weight races on the dirt, good for a 227 ROI, and he's obviously a barn that scores at a really high percentage, not necessarily always with high ROIs, but my preference was to use Mind for Passion. I also think that that Dame Cinco is very interesting. First-time starter by Cinco Charlie for Cherie DeVoe. This horse worked 10 1/5 at the Timonium sale back in June. That was postponed, obviously, from May. And 10 1/5 at Timonium is very fast, because basically you come off the hairpin turn and, you're not even at top speed when the furlong starts. And they're not, whipping and driving these two-year-olds in training sales anymore the way they used to. So this horse looks very quick, and I think that would tell you why they paid all that money for a horse by a very nondescript sire. In case anybody doesn't remember, Cinco Charlie won the Woody Stevens in 2015 on a day where American Pharoah won the Belmont. So it's a very nice horse for the Halleck Broads and Steve Asmussen, but obviously a small-time sire. And we saw Cherie do very well with two-year-olds at the Churchill November meet last year, so I don't think that's going to be any surprise. The other one I'm going to use is an A is Frosted Angel. Looks to be training forwardly. Progeny of Frosted aren't that great on debut, but there's some debut ability on the dam side. This horse is a half to a debut winner. The dam herself was a two-year-old debut winner. So not going to be surprised if this one's a little bit quick. And the inside post, I think, while it could lead to some unnecessary problems, it will also kind of prompt Corey Lannery to get this horse out of the gate as quickly as possible. Lannery's a good gate jockey. So I'm mainly going to use those three, the 2, 6, and 12. I'll back up with the 11. And the other horse I wanted to mention that I completely forgot is Abrogate. First-time starter for Steve Asmussen, who also looks to be training well. And this is one that has a good enough dam side pedigree, but is an outwork. And, of course, we've seen the outworks do very well in this crop, and they're generally ready to run early. So I'm going to use the 6, 8, and 12 as A's, and the 2, 9, 11 as backups.
I'll point out the $200,000 weanling purchase, the Spitestown Philly Rasky for Ken McPeak and Lee Pacoy. There's a little bit of sibling activity here. This is a half to Ready to Act, who you might remember from a few years ago. It was a stake horse and was actually fast sprinting and going long. So
It's just a little turfy, the pedigree. It's a good pedigree, just a little turfy.
There is, yeah, there's, you know, there's some other, it's funny, I think, as it happens, this is a Hertrick bred, but I think Pecoy actually owned a sibling of this. I think he owned one of those babies out of here. Summer of 54, I think, was a Pecoy horse, as it happens. And you mentioned Abrogate, the Leblancs. That gets us to the nightcap, or not the nightcap, but the anchor leg, at least, at Churchill. There is a 10th race at Churchill for those that want to play the pick four and pick five. And actually, the pick five at Churchill starts on the turf, a one-mile turf race. I talked about that group yesterday, which includes the sibling, the Dam, that's a sister of California Chrome, the one that that the Martin Zone. Anyway, the anchor leg of this pick five, the ninth race at Churchill, mile and 16th on the grass, first level allowance.
Yeah, this is an interesting bunch. I'll tell you, I thought that there was a really decent chance that Churn and Burn can wire this field. And I know he's breaking from the far outside, and that's not necessarily ideal, but when you're kind of have one way to go, I think it actually can end up being a positive. This is a horse who was involved in a very fast pace last time. Now, that being said, some of those paces going long on the turf at Keeneland in the fall were faster on paper than they actually were because they monkeyed around with the run-ups. And so this was a distance that was run with a substantial run-up. And the course was also very, very firm during this stretch of the meet. So I think we were all taken aback by how well Spanish Kingdom and Turn and Burn ran that day based on the pace. And I expected the race to completely fall apart when they went to, you know, the 1:10 and 3 to 6 furlongs. But it stayed together for the most part. I think Turn and Burn's very dangerous. He's obviously improved by leaps and bounds since getting onto the turf. I think the slightly shorter mile and a 16th trip is right up his alley, and so he was one that I'm definitely going to use, and I was certainly set individually in the race itself. A Telephone Talker is a horse that showed talent as a two-year-old, now is in the care of Mike Maker, and it's very clear that he's taken a step forward since joining Maker's Barn. I thought he was a game winner last time. A second-place finisher came back to win. Of course, the third-place finisher, Gear Jockey, looked for a second like he might win the juvenile turf last year in 2019 at a huge price. So I think you have to use Telephone Talker. And as far as other options, I thought there were maybe a couple you could make a case for. Perjury Trap is a horse that's going to get a lot of support. And people might point to the fact that he had trouble last time. He didn't have any trouble. That the steady is a very minor occurrence. It didn't matter. It didn't affect his winning position at all. That was a race, of course, where Montauk Daddy opened up a 15-length lead down the backstretch, and Don Juan Kitten got the first run before the closers really kicked in. And it ended up being kind of a subpar one other than, as it played out, given that Lonesome Fugitive, who was second in that race, came back and underperformed on closing day as the favorite. So I would be... I'm also wondering what kind of turf horses Chad Brown sent to Kentucky. You know, I don't know necessarily why this horse wouldn't have stayed in New York. He's got many more opportunities to run on the turf in New York, and it almost makes you wonder if the thought might be that the competition could be a little bit weaker in Kentucky, but it's not. This is a very, very tough race, and Perjury Trap's a horse to me that I would use only as a backup because he's going to offer no value, and I'm really... I don't think I need much more than Churn and Burn and Telephone Talker. If I wanted an off-the-pace horse, I'd probably take a horse like Attorney Tim, who's going to be making that one big late run, more so than Mud Pie, who I think, if he goes off his morning line of 7-2, will be a dramatic underlay.
You know, there's one horse in here that kind of I put the old question mark by, and Toma Toto, his best race that he ran at Sam Houston on the turf, you know, was long on the grass. That's his best run. The races on the synthetic have been, you know, and he tried the Jeff Ruby for a cameo, you know, on the Derby trail. But that race at Sam Houston in January is interesting. And you know, this is obviously, you know, the end of the year. He could very much be a different horse coming off this layoff. It's Asmussen, Santana, Jeff Bloom. And you know what Toma Toto is?
Drink everything.
I don't. Well, I it's like a dreidel.
That's what it means.
I guess in what in
Spanish.
Interesting in Spanish that's interesting. I didn't know, but it's a spinning game. It's like a dreidel. It's a toy. Like a top, like a spinning top. That some. I wonder if it's a drinking game then. Now that you say that.
Well, that would actually make a lot of sense, and would fit perfectly. But no, this is an interesting horse. You're right, and I was remiss in not mentioning him. And you know that Texas Turf Mile, that this was the inaugural running in 2020. And of course, the breakaway pace that was set in that race was done so by Jack and Noah, who came back and won multiple stakes races on the turf, sprinting, and Pixelate close to be second and ended up winning the Del Mar Derby. And Tomatoto was in the mix as well. Bodie Cream, who won the race, came back and was graded stake place, I believe, in the Saranac. So it ended up being a very productive race, and it was. He's actually run his two best races on the turf. And so the only concern for me is that, you know, layoffs have generally not been Steve Asmussen's thing, and, you know, understanding the relationship between Jeff Bloom and Asmussen based on Midnight Bizou, but this is a horse that it's tough to take a turf router away from Mike Maker and expect the same level of performance. But, you know, that being said, if this horse, if a mile in the 16th is within his capabilities, then he's definitely going to be very dangerous. I fear that he might be better a little bit shorter, but I don't know if I'd split hairs enough to exclude him if you want to use him at a, you know, as a backup maybe, or even as an A, depending on how your main horses shake out.
Well, this is actually the second of the cross-country pick fives. That'll be daily through the end of the Churchill meet, hooking up Aqueduct, the big A, and the big C, Churchill Downs. And 3:47, I'll have my take on it up a little later after the show. But Nick and I, whenever we get a chance, and we have a little 10-15 minute window to go over it, we'll certainly go over the Saturday edition, which includes some stakes action, when we talk tomorrow, and we'll get Nick's take on Breeders' Cup as well. Nick, I appreciate it. Good luck today.
Thank you, my friend. Talk to you tomorrow.
You got it, Nick. Tamaro and Tam 1215 for those on the Twitter machine. A little more than past the top of the hour. Let's take a break here. We've got a lot to do. We got visit from Alan Foreman next. Steve Askin, Tony Black, Rich Eng. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Don't miss a second of thrilling live racing from Aqueduct this fall on America's Day at the Races on Fox Sports. Watch Maggie Wolfendale, Andy Serling, and the entire all-star cast bring you the best of fall racing live from Aqueduct. For full TV listings, visit NYRA.com.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.